There is a Japanese film by the director Hirokazu Kurieda, and it's called Afterlife. And the setting is a kind of the recently deceased arrive in a what looks like a very humble kind of high school kind of campus setting, and the you know the recently deceased are charged with a task while in this purgatory like state, and their task is to identify the happiest moment memory of their life, and then to go about writing a kind of script to to film and direct, to recreate that moment. And then upon witnessing the performance of their production, of their film, they vanish into that moment for all eternity. Yeah. And it's this cast of characters who are tasked with identifying this moment of coming to grips with what their life has been, and then going about and actually documenting that moment. And, you know, the question that the practice asks us is like, is it possible that any moment of our life might be that moment, that any moment we would be willing to vanish into it for eternity? And we're trying to open our hearts to life such that that might be so, that in any moment it might feel like enough. But to do that, it involves the development of stability, of being here, of well-being, a kind of sigh, the ah of well-being, and the yes of confidence. Right? This is how we begin to make our life such that we know that any moment is a gateway to freedom. And so we've talked about these three capacities and the way they actually create a bedrock for insight, for cultivating. We cultivate, and then there's a kind of the conditions are set for insight. And to relate to our moments in this way, not to be free in every moment, but to have a kind of confidence that any moment contains the seed of freedom, we have to make peace with the human condition. Like to really actually see like what the rules of the game are, like the rules of this realm. What are the rules? And find some way of opening the heart fully to that. This is Leonard Cohen. Come back to this, these lines from the last album of his life. I wish there was a treaty we could sign. I do not care who takes this bloody hill. I'm angry and I'm tired all the time. I wish there was a treaty. I wish there was a treaty between your love and mine. A treaty between your love and mine. Many ways to conceive that, yeah. So the word dukkha, the usual translation is suffering, but it's been alternately translated as unsatisfactoriness, stress, anguish. And it really has two real senses. The first be of a kind of familiar, like we can't always have what we want, which is so obvious, but there's something about it that just, it's kind of, there's a part of the mind that is so incredulous when we like bump up against this. Like it's almost like suffering is like the first noble truth is like inconceivable to a certain part of the mind, you know? But then the second kind of aspect of this, and this is where we always say, like, oh yeah, the Buddha said, people say, like, the Buddha said life is suffering, you know, and we say no. But here's a sense in which he kind of did say that, just for a little uplift in the afternoon. No. The gesture of reaching out for an experience to complete the heart is a setup. And so whatever it is we chase after to actually bring the heart to a sense of completion will disappoint us. In other words, like, clinging can never work in the end. So, suffering is it's just woven into the fabric of being human, you know, this realm. It's like this is part of the rules, kind of. And rather than turning away, we actually study it. We study it in part to overcome this kind of vague, unconscious fantasy that somehow we might come to fully control the tides of pleasure and pain. So this is the writer Yuval Harari said that suffering is a kind of intellectual, but as a serious meditator in the Goenka tradition, and said suffering itself is real. I would say that if you want to explore reality, the best place to start is with suffering. Because it's the most real thing in the world. With happiness, it's very difficult to tell. Many times people tell themselves, oh, I'm very happy, and they're actually not. With suffering, it's usually much easier to know. The cause of misery may be an illusion or several illusions stuck on top of one another, but the actual experience for the person, this is the reality. So we actually Yeah, in a way, it's like this is how we can actually come to know life, come to know reality, is through attending carefully to suffering. This topic and this talk is not meant to be depressing. I may not succeed in that goal, and I did at one point in my life earn the nickname Captain Buzzkill. Because of my deep affection for the First Noble Truth. But suffering is fundamentally different than insight into suffering. And this is why my heart like just lights up with it. Here's Sayadaw Tejaniya. The noble truth of dukkha is discerned and is totally the opposite to the kind of dukkha one feels. The understanding of the truth of dukkha is wisdom. The mind feels strength, energy, freedom, detachment with this understanding. The mind's devoid of craving and the sources of suffering. Whereas the experience of dukkha is exhausting, the true realization of dukkha is free from the defilements, free from greed, hatred, delusion. Coming to actually make peace, make a truce with the First Noble Truth is the beginning also of a kind of radical love. That it's actually love, suffering is transmuted in a way. Suffering and awareness and equanimity is transmuted into love. Usually dukkha hardens the heart. You know, it's just we don't know what to do. We don't know why, and maybe we blame ourselves. But dukkha can remarkably soften the heart. There would be no path were that not true. There wouldn't be no path. Leonard Cohen, again, that famous song, even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah. So often people are knocked over and bewildered by dukkha. And I remember a talk Gil gave on this early discourses that he translated, the Atthakavagga, and just commenting on the Buddha's sort of disclosure of his own fear and concern at seeing the human condition. And so this is from that text. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. That's an unusual kind of frank description of an emotional response to seeing dukkha and dukkha not being comprehended as dukkha. Now, for some people, I would include myself before being exposed to the path, you know, really live in such a way to make this truth vanish. That the good life is to gain as much control over the first noble truth as possible. And the tricky part is that we can influence a lot, but it gives the false illusion that we actually control the tides of pleasure and pain. Because I can act out the itch on my face and scratch, and I can do that a million times, it gives the impression that somehow the tides of pleasure and pain are governable. We influence a lot, but control nothing, own nothing. And, I think there's a kind of, tragedy in, I feel like, in general, people just fidget from cradle to grave, It's like so heartbreaking. But there's something in the heart that that can relax and actually opening to this insight. And for me, it really feels like the first noble truth, that there is dukkha, contains the other three. That there is dukkha, that there is a cause, that there is cessation, that there's a path leading to its cessation. But it's like when we actually really take the kind of the Buddha's existential diagnosis, like when we really take that into the heart, it starts to free us of clinging. The heart starts moving along a path towards peace. The contemplative Christian monk Thomas Merton was a monk and his life was kind of retreat, but spent even more time, I think, in intensive practice. And he was asked, like, why do you go into retreat? And his response was to suffer effectively. Yeah. And we didn't put that on the flyer for this retreat, but may we all, suffer effectively. So, as Tejaniya was pointing to, the insight is fundamentally different than suffering itself. And Gil relayed one kind of moment of recognizing the depth of suffering pervasive in the world, and was talking recently with a Dharma friend, and she's doing a three-month retreat, I think her first three-month retreat, and just the pervasiveness of it, the seeming endlessness of it. Just like fully sunk into the heart, and it was just like the heart kind of just broke open, and not the kind of futility or hopelessness, but just like this reverence for the ubiquity of suffering. And to take that into the heart changes how we think about the prospects for happiness. I think we actually become more and more realistic about what a workable philosophy of happiness would be like, what a good life would be. The failure to understand dukkha leaves us to just be compulsively rearranging, of pursuing success in some way. This is a psychoanalytic writer, Adam Phillips. There are, as we know, people around for whom being successful has not been a success. There may also be people for whom success itself is a distraction, but for whom there is no language available to describe a good life free of success. We police ourselves with purposes, our ambitions, our ideas and success stories that lure us into the future can too easily become ways of not living in the present, or of not being present at the event, a blackmail of distraction. Believing in the future can be a great deadener. Perhaps we've been too successful at success and failure and should now start doing something else. So what would it be like to actually step out of the paradigm of success and failure? That feels like Dhamma. The First Noble Truth is not your fault. And that's it's hard to actually take that one in. It seems like, We so often misconstrue dukkha as some kind of commentary on the deficiencies of the self. But with this insight, there's really this sense of the kind of the innocence of suffering. There's a certain kind of innocence of it. I recent retreat, there's this woman who I saw in a meeting, and she made a deep impression on me. I was very touched by her life and practice, and she had suffered just about more than anyone I know. It was just thorough, deep suffering as a child. And remarkably resilient and getting into the path. And so after the retreat, she wrote, after listening to you teach, it dawned on me that what I've always thought of as my pain might what I've always thought of as my pain might actually be my heart. This is kind of blowing me away right now. Yeah, what I thought of as my pain might actually be my heart. It's like forgiving samsara. Yeah. This realm. Yeah, forgiving ourselves, forgiving others, forgiving samsara. This kind of opening to dukkha, it really kind of cuts through all of the kind of perfectionism and it's with the perfectionistic mindset, it's just really hard to actually open to the human condition as it's lived moment by moment. And in your own practice, in your retreat, a certain strand of perfectionism may kind of creep in and here's Norman Fisher to shake you out of any hope. It's hard being a human being. There's a lot to it. There really is. So I want to say in conclusion, let's all agree to accept the reality that we're not going to be able to do a very good job of this. There's too much to do. Isn't it a relief to know that it's not going to work out? And you can just forget about that to start with. So you're not going to get it right. You're not going to get it perfect. Don't worry. Just remember that there's no hope. But the important thing is, despite this and recognizing and embracing this reality, don't worry about finishing the job or doing it perfectly. But start, you see. Start and continue. This is the thing. You can really trust that if you will start and if you'll continue with commitment, that will be enough. So the heart starts to open to this this insight that in such a way that it's like our the way one of my teachers put it is like there's something in our being that's being kneaded like dough. And we start to actually like sense the redemptive potential of opening to dukkha. This is more from the Tibetan tradition, but Pema Chodron. Grief is completely pregnant with bodhicitta, the awakened heart. Completely pregnant with bodhicitta. It's full of heart, love, and compassion. We tend to freeze or harden against grief because it's so painful. We bring in the clouds. We're good at bringing in the clouds and keeping them in place. But when you practice the teachings that say, stay with grief, see it as your link to all humanity, you begin to understand that grief is a doorway to realizing that the sun is always available. You begin to have some more trust in the sun quality of your being. In this way, any experiences you have, particularly very strong emotions, are doorways to the awakened heart. The trick is to stay with the soft spot, the bodhicitta, and not harden over it. That's the basic bodhicitta instruction. Stay with the soft spot. Growing up, super aversive and judgmental and, you know, the greed, hate, delusion, like personality type, you know, you sort of gravitate towards one or the other. Very clear. Aversion, you know, irritation, hatred, that kind of, that was my favorite way to suffer. And, and now I'm like pretty nice, you know? And sometimes people like, people have known me over the years or just people who have only known me since I practiced, they're just like, all right, how did the practice get under your skin? Like, how did it actually work? For me, it was really, it was being softened by the First Noble Truth. You know, it was actually meeting suffering with tenderness, with equanimity. And something in that kind of process, actually, it really does. It feels like the texture of one's being is. I don't use this word often because it has a moralistic quality, but it feels like it's, oh yeah, purification. I see why that word is used in a lot of traditions. Purification. There's something. Yeah, it just becomes so much harder to hate when one has become really intimate with dukkha in a totally open, forgiving way. And you can feel it. You can feel it as it works through the system. You can feel it's like draining our capacity to like get super positional or to fail to see one's own foibles in another, you know, it just makes it harder and harder to hate. Now, In opening to dukkha, we're not trying to like re-engineer our preferences, yeah. Like sometimes there's a little misunderstanding of what it means to open it, like that we have to like it or something, or we have to be as okay with pain as pleasure or something. Story of the abbot Ajahn Sumedho, and I think a monk came to him and said like, this other monk is driving me crazy and, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm trying to practice with it. How do I deal with this? And Sumedho's response to the monk was, you don't have to like him. You just have to love him. Yeah. You get the sense of like, okay, yeah, I don't have to like this. But I can love it. it's possible to love. Now, in this process of transforming suffering into to love, the ingredient of equanimity is so key. And equanimity, that kind of balanced, poised quality of mind, feels kind of cool, but when it mixes with suffering, that it actually warms the heart. Equanimity in this context is like a radical permission, as radical permission to feel, is the way one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, put it. You know, radical permission to feel, a kind of increasingly frictionless relationship with experience, with the First Noble Truth. Yeah. And in that, in meeting that with equanimity, and meeting pain with equanimity, there is this, it can feel like the universe is sort of like squeezing us and stretching us and just working the fabric of our being. Sarah Lazar, meditator and a brain scientist, wrote a piece on equanimity with some other contemplative researchers, and she says, equanimity is a state and dispositional tendency that can be developed over time through specific contemplative practices. Equanimity transforms our sensory perceptual and cognitive emotional systems to widen our perspective on experience, more readily engage incoming sensory information, and more efficiently disengage evaluative and reactive behaviors when appropriate. Generally, this transformation is more gradual than the development of enhanced awareness, of present time awareness. Yeah. So, to widen our perspective, in suffering, the attentional field just collapses in, right? Like if you think of the worst moment of this retreat, very likely the attention was like pooled up and it just felt kind of confined, right? It's like suffering just starts to exclude the rest of the world, yeah? And the fact that we're like these super fragile creatures here in this, like, living in this geological blink of time on a fairly unremarkable planet spinning 1,000 miles a minute, an hour or something, like, that, we lose that. Yeah. Yeah. Right? Equanimity, we're actually like widening the perspective to more readily engage incoming sensory information. It's conveyed in our posture and the confidence, like, to say, like, yeah, that here I am. Here I am, life, come what may, I'm here. Yeah. And it's this lesson that slowly learned that when the winds of feeling blow, there's this sense that something in us will be blown over, yeah? But it's possible to let the winds of feeling, the winds of dukkha, blow without, yeah, with the sense like, yeah, but nothing will be blown over. There's this way we contract to like protect the jewel in the lotus or something, the jewel inside somehow. And there's this way that we just learn to not brace against experience, because we know that the wind will blow, but it will not blow anything over. And then lastly, Sarah Lazar says, to disengage evaluative thinking, reactive behavior. That's probably maybe akin to the second arrow of suffering. Yeah. Now, to appreciate dukkha, to have insight into dukkha, is to begin to develop happiness that is independent of conditions, a happiness that actually can coexist with the imperfection of the world. This is Shinzen. The greatest favor we can do for ourselves is to come to a state where our happiness is no longer dependent on conditions. Happiness that is independent of conditions occurs whenever we have a complete sensory experience. To have a complete experience means to experience something in a state of extraordinary mindfulness. Any sensory event, when experienced completely, becomes extraordinary and paradoxical. Its richness is maximal, but its somethingness is minimal. A complete experience of pleasure delivers pure satisfaction, but has little substance. A complete experience of pain is deeply poignant, but not problematic. A complete experience of desire is desireless. A complete experience of mental confusion nurtures intuitive wisdom. A complete experience of self convinces you there never was a self. We're pouring mindfulness into experience, including dukkha. And as we start to do this, to more and more deeply infuse experience with an awareness that lets go, our life is more poignant, it's richer, but the sense of the transparency of experience, the lightness of experience, becomes more and more prominent. Experience feels like it thins out, it becomes more and more like space. No matter what suffering is arising, when awareness is present, something else is always also true. Nisargadatta said, to say, quote, "I know myself," is a contradiction in terms, for what is known cannot be myself. And maybe we can say the same thing about dukkha, that to know dukkha is to know something other than dukkha. May we all be free. We can just all be quiet here together for a moment.